From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
One of the most encouraging parts of the current psychedelic renaissance is that it shows how quickly cultural attitudes can evolve. We've covered this before on the show because I think this has been a very good thing for the world and for the many people likely to benefit from it. At the forefront of this renaissance is a drug called MDMA. Many of you might know it as Molly or ecstasy. The drug has had a rather strange journey in the public imagination over the last few decades or so. In the 80s and 90s, it exploded with the underground rave movement.
They said half a hit of E would be fun.
And it was dismissed as a club drug. Before long, ecstasy was the target of tons of anti-drug propaganda.
No one knows how much brain damage the designer drug ecstasy causes.
One thing you don't want to play with is ecstasy.
And if you're old enough to have been in middle school during this era, as I was, you probably remember learning about how MDMA literally eats away at your brain.
And what's actually happening is over the next couple of days after taking ecstasy, the brain cells are actually being programmed to die.
Well, it turns out that was bullshit. And now MDMA is on the brink of being legalized for use in clinical therapy to treat conditions like PTSD. And that's just the start. So how in the world did that happen? And what have we learned about the therapeutic potential of MDMA? I'm Sean Elling, and this is The Gray Area. Today's guest is Rachel Neuer. She's a journalist and the author of a great new book called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. It's about the history and the evolution of this drug, from its creation in a German lab in 1912 to its status today as a breakthrough therapy. I thought I knew a good bit about the origins of this drug and how it works, but I learned so much from this book, and it reinforced my belief in its potential. So I invited Rachel onto the show to talk about why both of us are excited by research underway and what it might mean for the well-being of, well, all of us. And fittingly, for a talk about a drug that makes us feel connected, my conversation with Rachel began with some surprising shared history. Rachel Neuer, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Are you from Southern Mississippi?
Okay.
Is that right?
It is right. I'm from Biloxi, and I understand that you might be sitting in Gulfport right now.
Unfortunately, I am sitting in Gulfport. I am from Biloxi.
You're from Biloxi? No, you're not.
I am. I swear. Gulfport's our cross-town rival. But yeah, I grew up in Biloxi, Mississippi, of all places. And when I encountered something in your intro about running around in the lily pads in southern Mississippi, I was like, wait, what? There's another one of us out there?
Seriously. Well, thank God you're from Biloxi, because I didn't think I could talk to a Gulfport rival for an hour.
No, they're the worst. Maybe we have been in the same bar or something at some point. But
Project Lounge.
Oh, my God. That's a little bit too in the weeds. I'm gonna we're gonna lose everybody if we don't.
All right. Let's get to business. Yeah.
So, Rachel, you set out to become an actual scientist, and then you ended up pivoting into science journalism.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious what prompted that move for you.
Man, this is a common story for us science journalists, but I sucked at math. I was trying to make it work, and math was not a thing that I am built to do. And I just thought that I'm going to be a really crummy scientist if I can't analyze my own data. So I'm going to write about the things that I'm passionate about rather than actually do the science.
Okay. So there are a lot of different beats you could walk as a science journalist. Why psychedelics? And why MDMA in particular, of all things, to sort of plant your flag on?
I'll give you the roundabout story, which is, as we just touched on, I grew up in southern Mississippi. So beautiful part of the country, lots of nature. Mm-hmm. My mom was also like the local animal person in Biloxi. So if your mom maybe had found a squirrel or something that fell out of a tree, she might have brought it to my mom to take care of. So I really wanted to be an ecologist, a conservation biologist, and that's what I wrote about as a science journalist, a lot of illegal wildlife trade stuff especially, which is really depressing. So I did that for about 10 years, and I realized that I needed a break. And I was doing some soul searching at the height of the pandemic and was like, what else am I interested in that other human beings are interested in? And I may or may not have been on MDMA at the time I was considering this question.
Oh, no. Don't you do that. You were on MDMA when you had this idea.
Obviously, I was being coy.
Like, don't bullshit me. Don't bullshit our audience. We all know what that means.
All right, everyone. I was rolling. Well, yeah. And I was just like, what do I want to do with my life? And, you know, normally when I'm on MDMA, I'm just like, you know, in the moment, having fun, like synced with the music, hugging it out. But on this particular night, because it was the pandemic, I was kind of primed to do a little bit more introspection. And I realized, hey, I think the world needs a book about MDMA.
And is there something unique about MDMA, in your mind at least, that distinguishes it from other drugs and also warranted a book dedicated to the drug and its potential?
Yeah, I would say yes on both of those counts. So the traditional psychedelics like LSD, mushrooms, you know, where you can potentially have a scary trip, an ego dissolution situation, you know, realities unwinding, like you're plumbing the innermost depths of your soul. I love MDMA because it's very easy. I feel like I have more control in MDMA than I do on alcohol, for example. But at the same time, MDMA has the depth that other psychedelics do in that it makes me feel connected to myself, to others, to the world at large. So MDMA, yeah, it has substance, but it also is very user-friendly. As far as this moment, why MDMA, like why a book? MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD is most likely going to be approved by the FDA by this time next year. And that means there's going to be a lot more people with questions about this molecule.
There is some debate about whether MDMA should be classified as a psychedelic. I have always resisted that a little bit. I mean, I'm no authority on these things anyway, so what the hell... It's just my personal opinion on the matter, but MDMA has always seemed to me to be a categorically different kind of drug. And the experience of it, at least for me, has been very different from my experiences with other classical psychedelics like magic mushrooms or LSD or whatever. Do you think of it as a psychedelic, or do you think of it as sort of a psychedelic adjacent?
Okay, so it's definitely different. I used to be in your camp. So actually, when I wrote about the recent results that were published in 2021 on MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD for the New York Times, and they put psychedelic in the headline, and I was like grumbling about that. psychedelic passes a big test or something like that. And I was like, MDMA is not like technically a psychedelic. However, I've reevaluated that position since then because there's been new research that's come out that shows that MDMA, LSD, ibogaine, ketamine, and mushrooms all on the most basic mechanistic level, which is DNA transcription, seem to do the same thing.
Here's a basic question. What does MDMA actually stand for? I mean, people, the sort of the street name for this is Molly. More people may be familiar with that. And probably most people have heard the acronym. But what does that actually stand for?
Oh, man. Methylene dioxymethamphetamine. It's a methamphetamine derivative. It's also related to a really close molecule called MDA, which was a popular psychedelic before MDMA hit the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a stimulant.
So give me the origin story of MDMA. How and when was it created?
The origin story begins on Christmas Eve 1912, when the German pharmaceutical company Merck filed a patent for MDMA. And the thing is, they weren't actually looking for MDMA. They were looking for a blood clotting agent. And MDMA was just this chemical intermediary on the little chemistry steps to get to that blood clotting agent. So Merck denies that they ever discovered the psychoactive properties of MDMA, but there are some interesting hints in their records of scientists over the years. You know, we're talking a couple decades here, a couple decades there, being like, oh, this is a very interesting molecule. We should come back to this. I really wanted to get into those archives, but they stopped answering my emails. So, you know, I think the question is open whether or not Merck scientists ever actually discovered the psychoactive properties of MDMA.
The arc of MDMA in the public consciousness, for lack of a better word, is pretty remarkable. I mean, how in the hell does this drug go from a supposedly brain-eating club drug to an FDA-approved therapeutic breakthrough in basically just a few decades? I mean, just in terms of the drug's cultural reputation, mm-hmm. That's a wild, quick journey.
Big time. Well, I'll take you back a step even before that. MDMA was resynthesized in 1968 and then in 1975 by the psychedelic chemist Alexander Shulgin. He's in the Bay Area, very, very fascinating guy. He created around 200 new psychedelic drugs himself. He would test them on himself, and if they were interesting, he'd invite his nerdy friends over, and they'd all take the drug and sit around and, like, take notes about it.
Amazing.
So Shulgin resynthesized MDMA and tried it and was like, wow, this is very interesting. He called it his low-calorie martini because he could take a little bit of it and kind of plug right into that, like, happy, tipsy stage when you have that first drink of the night and you're chatty and feeling open and easy and happy. But he also recognized that MDMA had this additional property, which he described as a window. He felt like it was opening him up to access feelings and parts of himself that were normally boarded up just because of, you know, all of our own neuroses, our fears about what others think about us, things like that.
Yeah.
So Shulgin wound up introducing MDMA to a therapist friend of his named Leo Zeff. And I love this story. Leo was actually packing his office up because he was an older guy. He was retiring. He's like, I'm done with this whole therapy thing. And Shulgin shows up with some MDMA and is like, Leo, you really need to try this. Leo's like, no, I'm done with that. I'm moving on with my life. It's time for a quiet retirement. Well, a few days later, Shulgin's phone rings. It's Leo. And he's like, I'm coming out of retirement. I have work to do. So Leo had tried the MDMA, recognized that it was this incredible tool for psychotherapy, and became sort of a Johnny Appleseed of MDMA. This is 76. He's spreading it around the Bay Area and then beyond across the U.S. into Europe, teaching therapists to work with this new drug in pretty much any aspect of psychotherapy that they were already doing, whether it was couples therapy, trauma. Shulgin really causes MDMA to become this prolific therapeutic aid. And this is from about 76 until 85 when the DEA went to schedule MDMA. But the problem is MDMA, as some listeners might know, is a drug that makes you feel good. And any drug that makes you feel good is going to find recreational utility. And indeed, that's what happened with MDMA. It escaped from the therapist's couch, as people like to say, onto the dance floor. And that's when it caught the attention of the federal government.
So is it almost just sort of an accident that it just kind of falls out of the lab or out of the therapist's office and just becomes a club drug, and then it just sort of takes on a momentum of its own?
Well, one neuroscientist I spoke to, he thinks that MDMA was inevitably going to become a club drug. What he thinks wasn't inevitable was that it would find its way to therapy. He credits Shulgin and Leo Zeff for that. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it's an incredible drug in terms of what it does on the dance floor. And people noticed that and also saw the potential to make a lot of money off of that.
Yeah, I mean, I came of age as the rave scene was exploding. And
in Biloxi, Mississippi, yeah.
Well, State Palace, New Orleans, I'm sure you may have you may have been there a few times. That is where I first tried MDMA.
Oh, my God. You were so much cooler than me.
Not really. I was pantomiming cool, for sure. This is a good place to actually try to explain to people what MDMA is actually doing to someone when they take it. Tell me about the brain on MDMA.
Yeah, okay. So in general, what MDMA does is it mimics the neurotransmitter serotonin. Serotonin is sort of a jack of all trades, chemical messenger. It does all kinds of things for us. It regulates mood, sleep, appetite. You know, it kind of has a role in a lot of things. But what MDMA does is it causes your neurons to release around 80% of their stored serotonin. So you're dumping serotonin out into the synapses between neurons and activating all that chemical messenger.
80% sounds like a lot.
Yeah, massive dump. I mean,
so that is indeed. Serotonin floodgates fly open.
Exactly. Dumping it out. So if you think of an SSRI, an antidepressant medicine, they activate the same parts of your neurons as MDMA does, but what they do is they block serotonin from being taken back up by neurons, so it's more like readily available between your synapses. MDMA actually takes that a step further and acts as a reverse vacuum. It's like really actively flooding your brain with serotonin.
Wow.
At the same time, your oxytocin, you know, the so-called love hormone, gets pumped up. And there's a flurry of other things going on with different neurotransmitters, but serotonin is the big one and oxytocin. And there are findings in neuroscience showing that serotonin plus oxytocin is the formula for love. So hence that lovey-dovey feeling you get when you're, you know, rolling, as ravers like to say, on the dance floor, these waves of euphoria of, oh, I love everyone around me. I love myself. I love, you know, all these friendly faces dancing with me.
Anyone who has used some of those classical psychedelics we were talking about earlier, magic mushrooms or LSD, whatever, if you've done that, you know how much your state of mind, the set and setting, people like to call it, how much that influences the experience you have on the drug. Is MDMA like that as well?
Oh, yeah. Every psychedelic, and again, I'm grouping MDMA and with those psychedelics now, set and setting is really important. One thing I learned while reporting this book that I thought was really interesting is your heart rate on MDMA is the same as like the beats per minute as the average house music track. So it seems like early house music DJs plugged right into that. Somehow they intuited it, which is really cool. It's very hard to have a bad trip on MDMA if you're taking it in a recreational setting. There are reports of people, you know, going to a club and having repressed trauma suddenly come to the surface of their mind and having a bad experience that way. So if you're having a quote-unquote bad trip on MDMA, it's going to be one of sort of emotional meltdown because, you know, you're suddenly flooded with these memories or visceral facing of your trauma when you didn't expect it. But that's pretty rare.
Something that you talk about in the book is how when these chemicals, the oxytocin and serotonin, they get sort of ramped up in the brain. The brain's fear center shuts down or is at least quieted in a significant way. Tell me about that, because that seems to be a very important part of what's going on with MDMA.
Yeah, definitely. So activity in the amygdala, the brain's fear center, is really turned down. It's like you're just turning down the volume on your amygdala. For a recreational setting, that might make you feel more social. Like you'll be able to talk to people that you normally wouldn't. You don't have these sort of learned habits that we build around, like, oh, you know, I have to be cool. I have to be this way. They might think of me like this or that. Yeah. But in a therapeutic setting, that's really, really valuable because it helps you, first of all, bond with your therapist, trust them. And secondly, to access memories and think about parts of yourself that normally you just shut off because it's too painful or too frightening to interact with.
Fear is obviously a very important part of life, and it's not hard to imagine why fear was evolutionarily useful. We probably don't survive on the African savannah without knowing when to be scared shitless and run.
Absolutely.
But it's also equally obvious how pathological fear can become in everyday life, certainly today. And, you know, I don't want to sound like a philosophical cheese ball here, but maybe I will. Fear is, in some really important sense, the opposite of love.
Yeah.
And so this feature of MDMA not only takes us out of our own heads where we're not feeling shame or worries or anxiety about judgment, but we're more open to other people, and that creates the space for real connection.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I feel like fear is behind so many of our societal problems today, whether it's, you know, fear of immigrants, fear of jobs, fear of climate change, fear of whatever.
There was a study you mentioned somewhere in the book where apparently researchers dosed a bunch of octopuses with MDMA and they got high. Or at least they appeared to get high in the sense that their behavior changed dramatically. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So such a fascinating study out of Johns Hopkins. The neuroscientist behind it was Gul Dolin. Gul was interested to see if octopuses would react in the same way as people do to MDMA, because octopuses and human beings are less closely related on the evolutionary tree of life than we are to dinosaurs. Like 500 million years of evolution divides us. So she picked a very antisocial species of octopus, one that normally would just do anything it can to stay away from others of its kind, unless it's mating time. And she put an octopus under like a little mesh container and then had another octopus in another room. And she dosed the free roaming octopus with MDMA. And what she found was that this octopus began fluttering around its tank, kind of like a raver, you know, dancing on MDMA. And then when it came across that other octopus under the cage, instead of retreating immediately and getting as far away from, you know, its cage mate as it would normally, it literally tried to hug the other octopus. Like it wrapped its little tentacles around the cage and was just kind of latched on there. So those findings, in addition to being just like really weird and cool, are really profound because they show that serotonin plays this really, really mind-bogglingly ancient role in mediating social behavior and sociality. So, you know, an octopus who never will encounter MDMA in its normal life under the ocean reacts to this drug in much the same way we do. It just shows how important this sociality is for survival for all kinds of species, even ones very, very, very distantly related to us.
MDMA isn't just a party drug. It can be a very powerful therapeutic tool. I'll ask Rachel about that after a short break. Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT costs and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. What is it that you think makes MDMA so valuable in a clinical setting? You spoke to a lot of clinicians, people who work with patients in therapeutic settings to write this book. What did they say about this as a uniquely powerful therapeutic tool?
Okay, yeah, I'm going to nerd out now.
Yeah, go for it.
So I'm going to return to the lab of Gul Dolin at Johns Hopkins, the octopus scientist. Her even more profound findings in her telling, and also in my opinion, are findings around what it is MDMA is actually doing in a therapeutic setting. So, you know, not when you're going to a rave, but when you are going into a therapist's office and you're primed mentally to engage with your trauma or engage with your social anxiety or whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish in that office. And you've got a professional there to help you along and, you know, make sure you're not distracted from that goal. So under those conditions, her findings suggest that MDMA reopens in the brain what is called a critical period. Critical periods are just a neuroscience word for something I think we all intuitively understand about life and learning, which is that there are these finite periods of malleability, especially in childhood, when we are more open to learning new things. So think about, for example, the ease at which a child learns a new language compared to me who can't learn Spanish to save my life. And critical periods also close for a good reason, because if you think about how a kid goes through life, you know, they're like distracted by like a hand or a cloud. They're impressionable. They're gullible. That's a beautiful, wonderful time of innocence and openness for learning, but it wouldn't be efficient as an adult just for like getting through life and doing all the things we need to do. So the power of MDMA under a therapeutic setting is that it reopens a critical period for social reward learning. And this is basically just a time in life when we're really, really impressionable to like how we fit into the social structure around us, what other people think of us, like how we relate to other human beings. Yeah. And if you think about trauma, a lot of trauma is an impact of relationships gone awry. You know, someone has abused you as a child, someone has raped you, or you have committed a trauma against somebody else. You know, in war, you've committed atrocities, things like that. So the power of MDMA in that therapeutic setting is that it allows you to reevaluate and literally rewire connections you've built around your social world to let you, in a permanent way, change those habits that you've formed around your trauma.
There's a patient you quote in the book who describes her experience on MDMA as being transformed into a childlike state that allowed her to uncover some of these buried traumatic memories that she was holding onto. And I know some people hear stuff like that and they think, I don't want to uncover terrible memories. I want to leave that stuff in the dark.
Yeah.
But I think the mistake there is thinking that ignoring these things means they're not impacting us. This part of the book was just excruciating. The story about a man, I think his name was Dave or David.
Oh, yeah, Dave Pounds, yeah. Well, speaking to what you just said about trauma just being embodied in us, you know, that was one of my questions that I kept having for these trauma experts like Bessel van der Kolk and Gabor Mate. I'm like, well, why do we have to deal with it? Why can't we just ignore it and move on? And, you know, they didn't really have a satisfying answer. It was just like, because we can't. It becomes embodied in who we are. Like, we literally form neuronal connections around that experience of trauma. And if we don't deal with that, you know, that's just going to be who we are moving forward. So Dave was someone I interviewed in the UK, and he took part in an MDMA-assisted therapy study a couple of years ago for alcoholism. Dave just had absolutely crippling alcohol addiction. He had started drinking problematically when he was a teenager, and he was like on a trip to Amsterdam. It was supposed to be a really fun weekend with his friends, and he had met this girl on the ferry from the UK over to the Netherlands, and he really, really liked her. But, you know, come dawn, he was like, well, you know, there's no point in us staying connected because, like, you live in Belgium or something, I live in the UK, whatever. And then he realized once he arrived in Amsterdam that there was no way he could stay in touch with her if he wanted to. And he started absolutely freaking out because he's like, oh my God, I can't reach her if I want to reach her. He felt so powerless, and he started hyperventilating. He was having a panic attack, and he just grabbed alcohol and started chugging. And from that point on in his life, from his late teens, he would be seized by these horrible panic attacks. And the only thing that would calm him down was to chug alcohol. And he said, pretty much every therapist in the UK to try to deal with this. Nothing worked until he tried this MDMA-assisted therapy. And it brought him back to a memory when he was a kid of his mother being murdered and him witnessing that murder. And you know, before the MDMA therapy, he had recognized that surely these panic attacks are connected to that horrible murder that he witnessed, but he'd never been able to just deal with it because it was such, as you mentioned, a horrible thing. You know, you don't want to go there. And it was something he'd repressed his entire life. He and his father never spoke about it. He never told his friends about it. But the MDMA allowed him to actually engage with that memory in a way he never had before. And in his mind, to go and forgive the killer and also just tell his brain, you know, amygdala, you've been calling the shots, but like me and my heart are going to go forward now and take it from here.
If I recall, his mother was murdered downstairs while he was pretending to sleep in his bed. And he has a memory of the killer walking into his room.
Yes.
He just pretended to be asleep. And then the guy just leaves. It was tough to read for obvious reasons, but MDMA was able to cut through all that, all the usual defenses. And he, like you said, he was able to go into that memory, look at it, deal with it, find some peace, free himself from its grips. And I didn't want to bring that up so that we can just bludgeon people with a terrible nightmare of a story, but it's an important one. And, you know, there's another example from the book I have more ambivalent feelings about, but it's worth at least bringing up. And this is a young man who, I guess, become a pretty active white supremacist. Mm-hmm. And he ended up taking part in one of these MDMA studies. And it sort of de-radicalized him. Anything you can tell us about that you think may be important?
Yeah, he was more than a little bit active. He was the leader of Identity Europa's Midwest faction.
That's right, yeah.
Which is like a really notorious white supremacy group here in the U.S. You know, he was actively going around the country, including to Biloxi, where he visited Jefferson Davis's house to recruit people. Brendan wound up being doxed. His identity was revealed by some Chicago anti-fascists. He lost his job as a result. He lost his non-white supremacist friends. His family stopped talking to him. And it was during that time that he decided to take part in a study at the University of Chicago. You know, he just had nothing to do and needed a little extra money. He knew he was going to be given some kind of drug. He didn't know what it would be, and he didn't know what they were testing. But what they gave him was MDMA, and the researchers were looking into pleasantness of touch on MDMA. So there was like a research assistant who was tickling Brendan's arm with a feather or something while he was coming up on this MDMA, and he's like, what's going on? But suddenly he said he felt his mind kind of shift. And before he like took part in the study, he was thinking of ways not to reform, but to like kind of salvage the situation? Like, okay, you know, how can I pivot and get my job back? How can I get my friends back? Not like, oh, I need to reevaluate my life, but like, how can I fix this and still be the person I am? So as he's suddenly coming up on this MDMA and feeling this like little feather tickling his arm, he said this word popped into his head, which was connection. And he realized that connection with other human beings is the most important thing there is. And then he just started thinking about love. Like, love is what I'm supposed to do. Love is what we're all put here on the earth to do. And then he began questioning, like, why is it I've been doing what I'm doing? Like, I'm completely focused on the wrong things. I've been focused on hate. I should be focused on love. I interviewed Brendan about a year after he had had that big epiphany, and he wasn't, quote unquote, cured. He admitted fully that he still had a lot of bigoted beliefs, but after the MDMA experience, he actually contacted the guy who had doxed him, the anti-fascist, and was like, hey, how can I like become a different person? So they started this reading club where they were reading all these books about equity and racism, and he hired a diversity and equity coach, and he really started trying to become a different person and re-examine his own beliefs. So he says he still has sort of knee-jerk reactions sometimes, but he's able to check himself and be like, why am I feeling that way? That's coming from a place of fear, not from a place of love.
Part of my hesitation with bringing up anecdotes or stories like that is I'm very careful about not leaving the impression with anyone that, you know, we can just dose everyone with MDMA. We'll have the utopia we've always wanted, and no one will have any reason to fight or bicker or hate or whatever. And I don't think it's quite that simple. There are plenty of examples of people taking psychedelics and being pushed in the other direction. Charles Manson, a very famous psychedelic enthusiast.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
You know, so it's not a panacea.
Yeah. Brendan literally said, you know, if I had not been primed to reengage with myself and to reexamine myself, I would not have had this reaction. You know, he pointed out there's plenty of guys in the movement that he was with who love MDMA. It's not like you can just put MDMA in the water and suddenly everybody like starts hugging and, you know, wars are ended and things like that. Like, you have to be primed to do the work to change. Which is why, like, people aren't going into raves and having their trauma miraculously healed, typically.
We've got to take one last quick break. But when we come back, we'll talk about what's proven and what's anecdotal when it comes to the downsides of MDMA.
Wyze is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wyze just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wyze takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wyze. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wyze help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wyze worldwide. To learn more about how a Wyze account can work for you, download the app or visit Wyze.com. That's Wyze, W-I-S-E.com. Wyze.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
I'm a fan of MDMA. I've used MDMA. I will use it again. I'm glad that it exists in the world, but I also don't want to be irresponsible in the way we discuss it. And as you say over and over again, necessarily in the book, there is a lot of bullshit in the ether when it comes to these drugs. And that's partly the legacy of prohibition and all the taboos that created. But I do want to ask, what do we really know about the neurotoxicity of MDMA? Is it dangerous in any way? What do we need to know here?
MDMA is not going to eat holes in your brain, as you know we were taught in DARE in Biloxi, Mississippi, and elsewhere around the country.
I still remember that.
But yeah, if you take too much MDMA, it does damage your serotonin nerves. It can cause problems with memory. It can make you more prone to depression and anxiety. Too much is a subjective term. It's really subjective. The rule of thumb, though, is do not do MDMA more frequently than once every 3 or 4 months, just to give your brain time to recover, to rebuild that serotonin. I mean, there's other harms of MDMA that I'm happy to get into as well that are more environmental, like overheating. That's how most people wind up dying on MDMA.
Right.
Or taking adulterated MDMA because you don't know what's in your drugs because you're buying it from a black market unless you test it.
People sometimes talk about having these, let's call it unpleasant come downs after taking MDMA, where they feel like they've entered into a kind of brief or sometimes prolonged depressive state. And I guess that makes some sense to me. When you release so much serotonin at one time, that perhaps there's some deficiency on the other side or some kind of pendulum effect. Is there a clinical explanation for this phenomenon? What do we know?
So we do know that people in the trials of MDMA-assisted therapy do not experience that, you know, midweek blues, as people call it, or suicide Tuesdays. You know, however, that's in a very controlled setting with, you know, pure drugs of a measured dose, and people are dealing with really serious trauma or, you know, social anxiety, things like that. So let's set the therapy aside and just say, okay, we don't have any evidence that MDMA causes a mood crash for people who are doing it therapeutically. Recreationally, there's lots of anecdotal evidence of this happening. You know, it's common lore among drug takers that, you know, you're going to feel like shit after you take MDMA. The data, however, are pretty lacking, probably because it hasn't been studied. Most studies of MDMA have been funded through the federal government trying to prove that MDMA is this deadly drug. So right. The government isn't trying to see, like, you know, these lighter effects of drug takers like that. However, the best evidence we have in the literature was a study that was published around 20 years ago in Switzerland on around 75 healthy volunteers who took MDMA. And about one third of them did report a slight mood depression a few days later. So I think the best we can say is that a subset of people who take MDMA do experience some sadness or depressive feelings in the days after.
There is something jarring about the free fall from being in such a high euphoric state. And then suddenly you're not in such a euphoric state. And that can be, I mean, this is part of what happens in a more, I think, intense, shortened way with people who use cocaine. You just crash.
Yep.
Which is part of the reason why people end up doing more and more and more and more, because you don't.
Chasing that high. Yeah.
You're chasing that high. And when it goes away, it can be very deflating.
Well, I will say that I personally don't experience that mood crash on MDMA. If anything, I'm happier in the days and weeks after, because I have that experience to return to as a touchstone of like, oh my God, I had such a great night out. I love my friends. So good to feel that feeling again. But I'm definitely not discounting people's experiences.
You pose an admittedly tongue-in-cheek question at the end of the book about whether MDMA will save the world. I mean, the answer is obviously no, but it can help, right? So my question to you is, how much can it help?
Yeah, if only I knew the answer. Yeah, I just think that one of the big things I took away from this reporting experience of the book, I had no idea the amount of trauma and pain and suffering that are out there and that people are carrying around in them. It's just, it's staggering. It's a lot. And I really feel like if people can feel better about themselves, they will have more bandwidth, I hope, to care about other things, to care about other people, to, you know, care about the environment, to make the world a better place. And the reason we're in various predicaments that we are, you know, whether it's climate change or social inequity, is because of decisions people make. And if enough individuals make different decisions, maybe we can nudge the world into a more connected and loving and positive place.
Yeah, I mean, again, none of these drugs are panaceas. They're not going to fix you or the world. It's not like There is no drug to take that basically like pulling a lever and then everything shifts after that.
If only, yeah.
If only. But I don't really care about that. That's not the point. I think the point is that lots of people are suffering and suffering needlessly. And these drugs used in the right way can help. And I really like what Alexander Shulgin says about psychedelics. And you quote this in the book. He called them an expressway to the deepest recesses of the mind. And it can lead to answers to some of our most fundamental questions about existence and consciousness. But it's up to the individual to decide what to do with that. And it's up to the individual to decide how to use these tools. They can be used recreationally as mere entertainment, or they can be serious, life-altering, therapeutic technologies. How you use them, when you use them, really does matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also just want to say that I think having fun on MDMA or whatever your psychedelic of choice or whatever is fine. You know, fun in itself is a very worthy pursuit. And being happy, having a great time on the dance floor can make you more productive in the week after. I can tell you that for sure.
No, I am absolutely okay if people just want to alter their consciousness and have fun. I think the taboo against pleasure is a puritanical fossil, and we should trash it. These drugs are less toxic than alcohol, for instance, and there's no reason any of them should be illegal, in my humble opinion.
I am with you.
We are very obviously in the midst of this, I guess people call it a psychedelic renaissance, and MDMA is a part of that. What do you think comes next? What excites you? What worries you in terms of the move to integrate all of these things into the broader culture?
Oh, man. It's a really important question. I just came from the Psychedelic Science Conference in Denver that had like 11,000 attendees, and everybody's grappling with these questions in their own way. I'll just focus on MDMA since that's my area of expertise. I'm really excited for MDMA-assisted therapy to hopefully gain FDA approval for PTSD by this time next year. I think it's more than time for that. And there's so many people whose lives can be changed and like even saved by having access to this. What concerns me is access. So making sure the people who need the therapy, who want the therapy, can get the therapy. You know, MDMA is entering a healthcare framework that we all know is far from perfect in the US in terms of affordability and accessibility. You know, there's groups that are working on innovative ways to make sure it's affordable. It's looking like insurance will be covering it, but again, not everyone has insurance and not everyone's insurance will pay for the whole thing. And it's not going to be cheap because it requires two therapists to sit with you for 8 hours or something. So yeah, I'm concerned about access, but I do think that the first step is just making it legal. And I am really optimistic in that realm. So I think just following the data, but also not letting the data hold us back, if that makes sense. Like at some point, I think there's enough efficacy and evidence that we should just make the therapy legal for people who need the therapy, because there's just so much suffering. And the government has been dragging its feet on this for 30 years now. And think of the number of veteran suicides, for example, and just lives lost and lives ruined because people couldn't get access to this. We could always use more data, but I think it's time to, you know, try something new.
I couldn't agree more.
I wrote this book to be a resource for anyone who's even remotely interested in MDMA, whether you've taken it, you know, 500 times or zero times. I just find the culture, the history, the politics to be so fascinating, the science, of course. And I think MDMA is just this really fascinating lens through which we can view so many facets of society that shape our lives, whether we recognize that or not.
Once again, the book is called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. I have used MDMA. I am a fan of it again, but this was an education for me. There's a lot I didn't know. It was a real pleasure to read the book, and it was a real pleasure to have you on the show. So thank you.
Yeah, this is delightful. Thank you. Yeah, we'll have to catch up at the Project Lounge sometime over a couple of Vitas.
Oh my God. Eric Janikas is our producer. Patrick Boyd engineered this episode. Alex Overington wrote our theme music. And A.M. Hall is the boss. As always, let us know what you think. drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com. If you appreciated this episode, share the link with your friends on all these socials. New episodes of The Gray Area now drop on Mondays and only Mondays. Listen and subscribe.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
This podcast was supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.